Κι ήταν παιδί στα 17 που τώρα έχει πετάξει. Ήταν παιδί στα 17 που τώρα έχει πετάξει. Ποιος θα σου φέρει, αγάπη μου, το γράμμα που έχω τάξει. Ποιος θα σου φέρει, αγάπη μου, το γράμμα που έχω τάξει. Σαν πουλί που πέταξε η πικραμένη του ζωή, πέταξε πάει και του φύγε η δροσερή, η δροσερή. Ποιος θα σου δώσει, αγάπη μου, το τελευταίο φιλί μου.
Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording for the second time on the 19th of March, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 118 in the Beauty of Anthropic Dreaming. Well, here it is, formally speaking, a final Nav Briefing of the GNE. Of course, it's not the last that you'll hear from me. I'm already considering what to call the series of post-reset talks that I post on GaiaSpora.org. So GaiaSpora will continue with a new category. But in the future, the talks I post will be more random. I won't be confining myself rigorously to the time frame of the celestial writing, although, of course, I will refer to it as often as required, as often as desired. As you all know, I have observed and decoded the sky writing with meticulous care for a good part of my life. And as I open this final briefing for the GNE, I want you to know that I've never had an opportunity to share that experience, that exercise, that ritual of observation, if you will. Through my whole life, I've never had an experience to share it that involved so many people over such a long period of time. I can assure you that it's been one hell of a test for my stamina. And at the same time, it's been a huge privilege to have you along on that particular exercise. So I'm happy to know that some of you now have some confidence in watching the sky, in identifying the ecliptic, the prominent star formations, telling the difference between a sign and a planet. We conclude this GNE with a panorama of planets and constellations in the western sky that announce the arrival of the Calico War Party upon the stage of human affairs. That is no small matter. What is the Calico War Party? Well, quite simply, it's the consequence of everything we've done. It is the fruit of the Gaian navigation experiment manifesting in the world morally, existentially, creatively. It's simply a format showing each of us where we may stand and where to take a stand for the Earth and for the Anthropos. Remember that we navigate by the stars. She navigates by the stars. And she comes from the matrix of stars, which is the Pleromic core. Right now we have the delight to observe the double omen in the western sky, Mars and Saturn. In the eastern sky, before dawn, Venus. I want you to bear in mind that I invoke the Mahabharata and the instruction of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita in parallel with the Aztec complex and the story of Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca. I invoke these two mythological complexes simultaneously. They resonate across history at this moment, and they resonate out of the depths of the endopsyche of humanity. I teach directive mythology. That is to say, I don't merely teach how to interpret these myths or how to speculate about what they may mean. But I intend to show what they do, how they work, how they function, how they operate in the human psyche. You can see now in the Mahabharata, with its parallel to Russia and America, the deep background of the current decisive moment in this kalpa. And you can see in the Aztec complex the foreground that reflects the addiction and murderous insanity to which some members of the human race have arrived. So I propose that you carry these two narratives with you into correction. Remember that we enter correction during the shift of Swan Deva. She is the storykeeper. She is the only one of the Shakti cluster who operates through extended narratives. Of course, the supreme narrative is the Sophianic vision story, and she is the story keeper in regard to that sacred myth. But she is also the one who assists you, instructs you, and teaches you how to develop narratives and how to track the narratives, which are the directive scripts of human behavior, both for good and for ill. As a final point of instruction, at the conclusion of these 3 years, I'd like to remind you that whenever you consider the skywriting, or if you review the navigational parameters of the GNE concerning certain planetary cycles, concerning the lunar apogee and perigee moments, and so forth. When you look at all that and contemplate all that, be sure to keep yourself free of the error of causation. There is no causation involved here. The planets do not cause human behavior. They simply monitor it. I have shown that the appearance of Venus late in January can be timed almost day by day to to the events in Ukraine. There is a sequence of correspondences moment by moment between the events on the Earth and the emergence of Venus as the morning star. Venus is the omen of war taken from the Aztec complex, as I've explained. But does that mean that Venus causes war? Absolutely not. No more than Mars causes the formation of the Calico War Party. Or no more than Saturn circulating the apex or fulcrum of the scales causes me to teach Gaian ethics. The nature of the planetary writing is a display of biopsychic, historical, existential feedback. If you were wired up to a feedback machine, you would sit in front of a panel, and on the panel would be the display of your blood pressure, your temperature, your EKG, your heart rate, maybe your basal metabolic rate. There would be a range of windows on the display showing your bodily functions. Now, if you begin to think about something that happened to you, for instance, a dispute that you had with someone in your family that unfortunately led to separation and loss and physical conflict, perhaps even violence, then the figures in the display are going to show activity. The temperature, your temperature may rise. Your heartbeat would certainly increase. So you're reading the signs on the display, but it isn't the increased heartbeat measured on the biofeedback monitor that causes you to feel angry, is it? It's your anger being shown on the display. Well, I think I've distinguished myself pretty well over the years in my effort to show that the entire celestial environment of the Earth can be treated as a biofeedback display. I can read that display in real time. I can go back and read it in the remote past, and I can extrapolate it toward the future. For instance, if I go back into the remote past, in some historical era, say 1650, and I look at certain planetary cycles and certain lunar and solar cycles or stellar conjunctions during that time, in the granular detail, I can see fluctuations in the display. And from those fluctuations, I can infer events that are happening in the human endopsyche and in historical actions, historical activities and events during the corresponding period of time. That's how it's done. So don't think causation. Think feedback. Okay? Now, in concluding the last briefing, I touched on the subject of suffering, but I don't really want to leave that note resonating in the air. I don't want to end this series of NAV briefings on a negative or somber note, not at all, but I would like to address the topic of suffering briefly. Once again, and finally, just to put it in the right perspective, if I can. You know, I quoted a little exchange from sayings attributed to the Chan master of the 10th century, Hui Hai. And I don't know about the rest of you, but if you have ever read into the area of Chan or Zen, you come across many such exchanges. More commonly in Zen, you find a master posing a koan to the disciple, and you find other types of enigmatic exchanges, and truth be told, you really had to be there to get it. It's difficult and dodgy to carry forward these exchanges in a fossilized form in writing. They're exchanges whose meaning evaporates in the pure spontaneity of the moment. In Huihai's response, I find the last sentence to be remarkable, but I feel a compulsion to modify it a little bit. Quote, "In all the world, there is no place where living beings do not have to suffer." Is that what he said or not? We don't really know, because this was, you know, recorded sometime after. It doesn't really matter. What I would like to say is that in all the world, there is no place where human beings can avoid the question of suffering. I ask you to consider that there is the fact of suffering, and then there is the question of suffering. Now, as regards the fact of suffering, let's agree, if we can, that we hold to a crucial distinction. There are two classes of suffering, let's say. The first is that suffering which may just accidentally happen. You can have an accident in a car, or you can lose a loved one also through some eventuality that is not due to deliberate human intention. So if I lose my daughter in a swimming accident, if she drowns, that is quite different than if I lose her at the hands of a murderer. So I suffer in both cases, but the suffering is not the same. I consider it essential that those who want to be part of Sophia's correction do not turn their gaze away from the question of suffering. Now, when I wrote Not in His Image, I made a point regarding suffering. I consider it to be one of the most important statements that I've ever made, and if I had to pick out one single line in Not in His Image, that is, to me, my favorite line, of which I am the most proud, it is the opening of chapter 19, a message, a unique message of love. Quote, "The divine victim mirrors to humanity not the solution of our suffering and a way to overcome it, but our total consuming enslavement to it. Victimage works because it makes the force of suffering look stronger than the life force itself." End quote. So, one of the first lessons about suffering, well, perhaps I would venture to say the paramount lesson, is that the victim-perpetrator syndrome traps the human animal in a form of emotional enslavement due to the way it represents the force of suffering as stronger than the life force itself. That is an error from which large numbers of humanity cannot ever recover. So whenever you face up to the question of suffering, or better said, the question about suffering, you are really facing up to your humanity. You know, all animals suffer, and probably microbial animals may suffer in some way under stress. plants suffer. That was proven in the secret life of plants. They will even suffer from destructive or harmful thoughts that are directed toward them. But what makes us human is that we can stand before the question about suffering, and they can't. They don't stand before the question. They just suffer. So the way we handle that question is supremely important, isn't it? Now, I leave you with a distinction between suffering that may happen and suffering that is deliberately inflicted by other human animals. In nature, you can see the operation of the prey-predator bond. Now, never confuse this with the victim-perpetrator syndrome. They're not the same. In nature, you see many illustrations of the prey-predator bond. It's part of the symbiosis of the web of life upon this planet. It's an aspect of Sophia's dreaming. It is not comparable to the violence and depredation reaching the scale of genocide that is typically committed by human animals, is it? No, it is a transaction between different species of animals in a very limited range of selections and in a limited quantity of kills. That is the prey-predator bond, and in the Calico War Party, we in fact observe that bond as a paradigm for the mission to be undertaken. That is to say, to eliminate interspecies predators. There are no interspecies predators in other species. That is unique to humankind. So the two points that I want to make clear about suffering are, first, hold that distinction. When you hold that distinction, you can discern a lot about the way things happen in this world or about the way they don't happen. Sometimes good things don't happen because they are deliberately prevented from happening. That is a form of harm against the child and against the human spirit and the beauty and creativity of the Anthropos. You can harm people's lives by suppressing them and not allowing them to unfold and share their natural talent. And that is another aspect of the suffering due to deliberate human action, deliberate human behavior. And additionally, of course, there is deliberate human behavior that leads to murder and havoc, material havoc on a grand scale. And who is there to stop that behavior? How do we stop that behavior? So I've said, and I'll say it again because I like to hear myself say it, that what this world needs is a warrior class to defend humanity against the predators in its own midst. And anyone from any culture, any country, any background, any tradition can be a member of that warrior class. The Calico War Party is the template for the formation of that warrior class. Now, the final thing that I want to say on this grave topic of suffering, before I segue into the more appealing topic of beauty, is this. Those who would enter the Calico War Party, that is to say, the follow-up of the GNE into correction, Well, you all need to be really, really clear in your minds that you intend no harm to perpetrators. You see, it's not about harming them. It's about destroying them. That is the challenge. Challenge is not to harm them. I have an aversion to harming anyone, but I don't have an aversion to eliminating those who harm. Do you know, it doesn't harm someone to shoot them in the head. Did you know that? It doesn't harm them at all. Harm is what they do to their chosen victims. Harming the web of life, harming nature, harming children by pedocidical perversion, harming, maiming, and killing. That's their pleasure. That's their game. But those in the Calico War Party, except perhaps in a few instances now and then, I'd say there's some latitude in this. There are ways that you can kill someone that's painful and slow. But just killing someone is not harming them. There is no intent to harm. Intent to kill is not intent to harm. Intent to eliminate is not intent to harm. So free your heart from that burden. You don't have to become a nasty animal who likes to harm others. But you have the option that if you get the opportunity to eliminate someone in a slow and painful manner, well, you can do it if you like, if you think you'd enjoy watching it. So the point I'm making is that the Calico Warrior does not respond to the intent to cause suffering with an equivalent intent. As a Calico Warrior, I do not have the intent to cause suffering to anyone or to harm anyone, even those that I would eliminate given the chance. If you're going to hold the intent of a Calico Warrior, whether you act on it or not, if you're going to hold it simply in order to support those who do act on it, to give them moral support, then you need to be absolutely clear that it has nothing to do with the intent to harm. And that's another dimension, another facet of this topic of suffering. So we face the question about suffering, the war that humanity must win in order to save itself, the war that must be fought and won so that humanity can live and thrive on this planet in harmony with Sophia's dreaming and with the entire natural world. That is a war against the suffering that is deliberately inflicted by human animals. That is the clearest formulation that I can give you, and that is the message I would leave you with as we make our departure from the GNE into correction. Now, I can see that there are three vectors that will occupy me in the near future. I can see that I will be occupied by Celestics. I will be in some manner teaching Celestics. That project is already underway. I will also be occupied with Gaian Alchemy. You will note that through the motif of Fukushima Mon Amour, I found myself reviewing the course, going back to the concept of eco-psychology, returning to the first terma that I received, the Gaia Sapiens Exchange, and so forth. So I expect that in the future, I anticipate that in the coming months of correction, I will be involved in some way turning over that material. So turning over star lore and star base to Celestics, turning over alchemy, revised and reframed in a modern form. And the third vector of my activity will be the Calico War Party. So, what you will see soon will be a new category on Gaiaspora.org for future talks that I give, which are continuations in some respect, but in a loose and occasional manner of the GNE, picking up the topics as they come to me and as I would enjoy discussing them with you or presenting them to you in the lack of an opportunity for discussion. The Calico War Party requires another platform. So the domain has already been purchased, but I can't see right now what form that would take. My commitment to teach Gaian ethics and to develop the Calico War Party has to be presented on another platform. So, in one way or another, I'll be working with some of you to set up that platform in the near future. Bear in mind as well that I have here the complete template of the Calico War Party with all 16 positions and the assignments to the Dakinis and Mahavidyas. That is to say, those who are assigned to each of these positions. And that too has to be made available. So at some time in the near future, I will post that, but I'm not sure exactly how or where. Now we have a 4-day or 5-day window here. Don't forget that. Some of you won't hear this talk until maybe the 20th or 21st of March. I want to assure you that between the 19th and the 24th, when the hinge of Swandeva appears, we have a window of opportunity to assimilate everything you've learned in the GNE and to settle into the transition. Remember that I noted that on the 23rd of March, Venus reaches 16 degrees of Aquarius, which is in the arc of the goatfish, and that is the position of the last perigee of the moon on the 27th of February. On that day, or immediately thereafter, you will see the hinge, the last quarter of the moon of Swandeva, shift. And so these celestial events may be taken as signs of the way that we ease over from reset into correction. There is not a sudden and abrupt jump. It doesn't have to be that way. The first perigee surge in correction occurs on the 27th of March in 25 Aquarius, that is to say, in the tail of the goatfish. The tail of the goatfish, remember, is like a spiral. And the tail of the goatfish has a spiral power to it. It represents a spiral turbulence. The dreaming of the Aeon Sophia operates through a spiral turbulence. Dreaming of the Aeon Sophia is material. Everything is material. It is material. And when you are in touch with it, you feel the gentle rush of this spiraling turbulence. Turbulence, as I've said for 5 years now, is a characteristic of being in the presence of the Shakti cluster. Okay, so far so good. It's difficult for me to make this recording this evening. But coming around the 35-minute mark in this briefing, I'd like to quickly make a few corrections, point out a few corrections that I consider to be quite important. I've skipped them over and over again. I wouldn't like to conclude the GNE without covering them, or however briefly. And then I'd be happy to cruise into the titled theme of this briefing. As I do so, in fact, right now, if you don't mind, I'd like to change to the first person because it would be easier for me to complete the briefing in that way. A while back, I said some things about unconditional love. I was really reticent to make those remarks, and I feel compelled to add a comment, namely that I left something very important out. But first of all, that those are just my personal views on unconditional love, and they're idiosyncratic. They're particular to me. I do not want anyone to be unduly influenced by those remarks, so I ask you to step back and take a distance from what I said. It's funny, when I was preparing to do the briefing in which I talked about unconditional love, I balked and stalled, and I kept saying to myself, okay, finally, when I decided I would do it, I said to myself, okay, John, you're going to do it, but guess what? I bet you're going to leave out the most important thing. And I did. I would refer you back to the Wheel of Compassion. It has 6 spokes consisting of complementary virtues, if you will, complementary capacities. So, for instance, love is complementary to indifference. Recognition is complementary to denial. And hate is complementary to empathy. Now, recently, I spoke of hate and generosity as being complementary in the context of the Wheel of Compassion. Compassion is the hub of these 6 spokes. Got the picture? Well, hate and empathy being one set of opposing spokes, hate and generosity, it's the same thing. What is generosity but the most extreme form of empathy? It's a form of divine empathy, in fact. So you can stick to the model of the Wheel of Compassion. And you can play with these variations. Hate, complementary to empathy or to generosity. But I bring your attention to the complementarity of love and indifference. What I neglected to say about my idiosyncratic experience of unconditional love concerns the evidence or proof that you have indeed realized what that is. There has to be proof. Human animals require proof. We are storytelling animals and we require proof. Both of those needs of the human animal make us extremely vulnerable. If we are told lies, we enter into deviance through the lies in the narrative. If we are not given proof, or if we are given specious proof, we become fearful and confused. The proof that you have realized unconditional love. Now, back to the first person. For me, the proof that I had realized unconditional love came to me with a certitude that I could handle absolutely anything, and with indifference. Anything. It's interesting to reflect on that complementarity, I think. You may find it so, I don't know. If you were here in front of me, I guess you'd tell me, and then we'd have a different kind of event happening here. You know, it would have been so much easier for me to do this, GNE, if I hadn't been alone here in this room. So I'm greatly relieved that it's finished in that respect. Anyway, what I'm saying is that all considerations of unconditional love that I've heard through the years, all those teachings about love, which Rajneesh warned have destroyed the genuine capacity for love, have stressed the beautiful, lovely, spiritual, kissy face qualities of love. But love is a warrior virtue. I tell you, it is. And the warrior to be able to undertake this mission of the Calico War Party must be able to handle anything that comes your way. And it is actually, in my experience, the anchoring in unconditional love that allows you to handle anything and be completely indifferent to it, because love and indifference are complementary. I neglected to mention that point when I was talking about unconditional love. Now, another small correction I want to make is regarding the five skull crown teaching of Vajra Yogini. Recall that the central crown is the largest one on the forehead. It represents the poison of envy. The other two crowns to each side represent different human poisons. But hold on a minute. I have also said that envy is not a trait of the Anthropos, but it is due to a foreign installation of the Archons. We are infected with envy, but it is not comparable to the other four emotional poisons which are endemic to the human animal. Well, consequently, if the central and most powerful of the five poisons to be transmuted is not of human origin, namely envy, then how can it be converted? We can only convert by moral alchemy, if you will. We can only convert those emotional poisons that are endemic to our system, to the design of the Anthropos. Envy is not endemic. Therefore, envy does not have to be transformed through the five skull crown initiation in the way that the other four emotions are transformed. This is all the teaching of Vajrayogini. She oversees one of the ranks in the Calico War Party, one of the front ranks, just behind the first three ranks. Vajrayogini stands beside Bharavi in the second line of attack. So the teachings of Vajrayogini on the five skull crown would be the speciality of those warriors assigned to her rank. Can you see that? There are lots of things to do in the Calico War Party. You need to know your assignment. You need to know your speciality. Okay, so I was mistaken if I implied that envy can be transmuted like the other four emotional poisons represented on the five skull crown. No. Do you know what you do with envy? You meet it with contempt. That is the proper response to envy. Contempt is a wholly human trait. I can tell you, I'm full of it. I'm full of contempt. I can even say that having undergone these 3 years with you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment, my contempt for the human species has reached untold levels, unanticipated levels. My contempt for the human species has gone off the fracking chart. And it will probably stay there for the rest of my life. Why do I feel such contempt for the human species? It's my response to the victim playing accessory to the perpetrator. And it's my response to the slavish devotion of people who are subjugated to the envious ones, to the righteous. The slavish devotion to their oppressors. They idealize and idolize those who destroy their lives. This is what human animals do. And I have absolute contempt for them as much as for those who destroy their lives equally. Contempt is a very powerful immunatory response, an immune response. Contempt can be really beautiful. Contempt is a lovely blade. Keep it sharp, keep it clean, and you can use it in every single instance of your life to cut yourself out of the horrific enmeshments into which the human species has fallen through the victim-perpetrator syndrome. Contempt is the single most effective weapon against envy, and it keeps you clear of that syndrome. Now, as I come to the last half hour of this briefing, it might be appropriate for me to answer a question that could possibly arise in your minds, in the mind of anybody who's listened to what I just said. And here's the question. Well, John, if you feel so much contempt for the human species, then why are you doing so much for them? Why are you doing so much to help them, to teach them, to give direction to members of the human species? Why are you acting like someone who cares about what happens to humanity? Well, my answer to that is simple. I don't do anything to save or serve humanity. That is not my motive, and I have said before that service is not in her syntax. Salvation is certainly a toxic syndrome in the human mind that no one in their right mind would embrace. I don't do what I do to save or serve humanity. I do it from the love of truth and the love for beauty itself. I do it so that I can live in beauty, and to hell with everything else. That's where you'll find me from now on. If you wonder, some days, how the nav is doing, well, you can be sure that he lives in beauty. You can be sure that beauty dances him right to the end, last tango in paradise. And whatever beauty you find in your lives, be it in the smallest thing or in some grandiose project, like the Gaia Navigation Experiment, whatever beauty or even clues to beauty that you find,
will always tell you where he is. Because it's one beauty consuming us all in the anthropic dreaming. One beauty consuming us all. That's where the human animal wants to be. Not in the psychodrama of history, is it? No. What a talented animal is this creature. What a brilliant child. What an inspired animal. And my beauty, like yours, all folds into the great orchestration of the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia. The ultimate dreaming together is just that. You're dreaming of your life and her dreaming of it at the same time. For me, as you know, mythology is not just my calling, but it's the practice of my life. So I live through myths, the myths that can be read in the starry constellations. You can read them too. You can learn what is the myth you live, the myth you love, and the myth you teach. Well, as you know, the Nav was born in the heart of the scorpion. So the myth that I live is that myth of the journey into the underworld to seek hidden treasure. The myth that takes the form of a love story in the Greek legend of Orpheus and Eurydice. And you might also recall that I rewrote that myth in June of 2008. As far as I know, it's the first time that a mythologist has ever attempted to rewrite a classical myth. And I made it so that Eurydice returned from the underworld. Orpheus did not lose her by looking back. And when she returned through the power of her voice, as the myth says, Eurydice sang a song of thanks and love to Orpheus. And she called him Agapemou, my love. And you can hear the strains of that song sometimes around me. If you catch the strain of that song in the wind, you'll know where to find me. Thank you.
Now, what if... what if I tell you something that I've not said before, publicly or openly? It's a little clue of personal disclosure, but it's not really meant personally. There's a transpersonal message inside it. Back in June of 2008, when I rewrote that myth so that Eurydice did return from the underworld to be reunited with her love, I was intently pondering a proposition. I was wondering if the act of rewriting that myth would change the circumstances in which I was living at the time as a reflection of that myth. Now, a myth is a powerful narrative, right? But the force of circumstances in human experience is equally powerful. People make choices, things happen. So I wondered if the power of myth would be great enough to change the story I was living existentially. So I have to admit that when I rewrote that myth, although I did it spontaneously and hardly without thinking which sentence would follow the next, I mean, I undertook to write it one afternoon without knowing how I was going to change it until I did. Okay, I have to admit that I was wondering if rewriting that myth would bring my Eurydice back to me. And you know what? It did. It did bring her back. And what is quite remarkable is that the rewriting of the myth produced a different ending. And yet, the different ending had to be lived as a new story. And so I had no idea how the different ending would work out in actual life, in real life. But it is a fact that 1 year and 1 day after I lost my Eurydice, she returned. And when she returned, she came with a song, that song that you just heard. What I could not predict in rewriting the myth was that my Eurydice would bring me a song of gratitude and love, calling me Agapemo, but that she wouldn't sing it in her own voice. So she presented it to me in the form of a CD. Oh, you see, the moral of his story, my friends, is that you have the power, through the beauty of your dreaming, of your own life, to direct the circumstances of your life. It is the beauty that does the work. It is the beauty that does the magic. Just as happens in a rite of Gaian courting, the more beautiful the act of doing the courting, the more beautiful the finished courting, the tri-yantra, the more effective will be the spell transmitted through that cording. And it's the same with the thread or cording of your life story. What is the anthropic dreaming? Is the thread of your life in the weave of her planetary dreaming? The thread of your life is made of fibers that are of deathless strength. Fibers that connect all human animals across time. And those fibers are known to us as myths. The thread of your life is woven of those fibers of myth. So you find yourself in her dreaming through your own dreaming. That is the ultimate dreaming together. You and the Aeon Sophia. Me and the Aeon Sophia. And this dreaming is a fantastic adventure, full of surprises. I can guarantee you that. It never occurred to me that my Eurydice would come back and sing to me in someone else's voice. Not a bad voice, huh? Savina Giannatou was a Greek diva. So, there you have it. The beauty of anthropic dreaming is the greatest gift of the human species to the universe. The dreaming of your life is something beyond just the living of it. Dreaming of your life is a gift back to that source of life. This is the moral of Severed Rose. Life is a gift within a gift. And so it's not to save humanity, believe me, or to serve humanity, most of which has fallen into a contemptible state, but it's purely for the pleasure and thrill of dreaming your life as well as living it, as I do, as we have done together in this magnificent experiment. Everyone who comes across Planetary Tantra, and by extension, the GNE, finds out sooner or later that I received the terma of Gaia Awakening in the aftermath of a tremendous emotional trauma, an experience of loss, betrayal, and abandonment. A triple whammy. And it just goes to show that there ain't nothing that you can't turn around. And when you turn it around, whatever is difficult and challenging in your life, whatever works against you, whatever threatens your happiness, whatever happiness you may have, when you turn it around with the boost of the earth, there's no telling what you can do. So everyone knows how the term of Gaia Awakening came into this world. And now you know that she came back. Yeah, it was Emma who gave me that music. Thank you, Emma.
but there was no way for me to tell what would happen when Eurydice returned. There's no way for you to tell what comes to you by living your myth. Because to live it truly is to relive and recreate it. And so all those myths that you are living have endings to be rewritten, you see. Now I myself have written the second part of the Orpheus trilogy, The Return of Eurydice. And the third part, The Flight of the Black Swan, has yet to be written. But in case you're wondering what the Nav is doing now that he doesn't have to think about the GNE morning, noon, and night, and even when he's asleep, well, you know that I spend some time rewriting these myths. The Return of Eurydice would be called The Beauty of Goodbye. The Beauty of Goodbye. Yeah, that's something to dream about. I think that one of the really painful recurrences in human behavior happens when you enter into a merge of dreaming with someone. You decide to dream your lives together, okay? It's natural for human beings to do that. But you find that you cannot end in the beauty in which you began. Back in 2008, I thought that I had to insist on that principle. I thought it must be a tantric principle to end in beauty what you began in beauty. Well, you can try. But you see, the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia relies on our love in a very special way. It counts on us coming to love each other as much as we love the mother. Now, I love the mother more than any of you, and I'm not reticent to tell you that. I love the earth supremely, and I never, ever want to leave her. I go with her to her journey's end. And what inspires me now and fills me with joy, real joy, is the sense that my love for some human animals can attain the same height of my love for her. This happens in our concerted dreaming. It does happen. And this is what she wants, I'm sure. So it's good to talk about love at the end of these briefings, 118 to be exact. It's good to feel love. Feel it like an elixir
that exudes from the pores of the earth itself. Everything is material. Even love is material. In the alchemy of her dreaming. We're all tantricas now, if you choose to be. The complicity in her beauty is voluntary. And the tantric path of the GNE is the same as the tantric path that goes into the Kalika war party. In Tantra, the root, the path, and the goal are one. They're all one. And the direction is one. The direction you have found in this experiment is one direction that we all follow. And that is the direction into the sacred life, to revere beauty, to worship beauty, to make beauty, and be the grateful beneficiary of the power you acquire in doing just that.
Thank you.